From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics this week review the new film from writer-director M. Night Shyamalan, Glass, starring Samuel L. Jackson, Bruce Willis, and James McAvoy. Also, Fire, The Greatest Party That Never Happened, and Fire Fraud, two competing documentaries about the Fire Music Festival that went awry. Also, Oscar-winning cinematographer Caleb Deschanel. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm a Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. We're going to get to this week's movies, and a little bit later, we're going to talk about the best shot films of all time, the American Society of Cinematographers with its top 10 list, as well as 100 best films of the 20th century for how they were shot. We'll get to that, but our critics joining us this week, Lael Lowenstein and Justin Chang, LA Times film critic. We start with the sci-fi mystery Glass. M. Night Shyamalan wrote the screenplay, directs the film, and follows up on his earlier movie Split and Unbreakable. It stars Samuel L. Jackson, Bruce Willis, James McAvoy, and Sarah Paulson.
Everything extraordinary can be explained away, and yet it is true. I think deep down you know this. Everything we will see and do will have a basis in science, but it will have limits. This is the real world, not a cartoon. And yet some of us don't die from bullets. Some of us can still bend steel. That is not a fantasy.
Justin, you want to start us on Glass?
This is basically the latest entry in the M. Night Shyamalan cinematic universe, the MNSCU, I guess we should call it. And as you said, it's a sequel to not only Split from 2 years ago, starring James McAvoy, but also Unbreakable, his 2000 drama with Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson. I think this is sort of a strained, kind of dopey mess of a movie that I nonetheless admired in certain ways. I think it distills everything that's good and bad about M. Night Shyamalan. It does show him trying to move forward and break some new ground and put this interesting novel twist on the superhero movie, but I think he falls well short of the mark in the end. I'll try not to give away any spoilers, which are always dangerous territory with Shyamalan, who is known for his climactic rug-pulling twists. But if you haven't seen Split or Unbreakable, you might not want to listen to all of this. But in Split, you know, James McAvoy played the serial kidnapper with a severe case of dissociative identity disorder. He had 23 different personalities. It was a very showy, over-the-top acting tour de force. That movie revealed itself in its final moments to be connected to Unbreakable, where Bruce Willis played the overseer, David Dunn, this almost invincible, physically shatterproof superhero, and Samuel L. Jackson was his nemesis, this brittle-boned, but very intellectually formidable nemesis. And now Glass brings them all together, and it basically contrives to imprison them in a psychiatric ward for much of the running time, kind of a remarkable amount of the running time. They are just trapped here and under watch by the psychiatrist who's played by Sarah Paulson. And she is basically trying to debunk them, to convince them that they are in the grip of a delusion and they don't really have superpowers or extraordinary abilities, and there are scientific rationalizations or explanations for everything that they do. And so this is kind of a movie about how do we still have faith in our superheroes, you know, or our supervillains even. And so I think Shyamalan is trying to do something interesting with the superhero movie. The problem is that we've had such a glut of these films and such a glut of comic book adaptations that it just doesn't have the trenchant quality. It doesn't have anything revelatory to say, really.
That's all true.
Yeah.
We've also had some good superhero movies. I mean, some of the Marvel films have been really good. We had a great Spider-Man movie recently.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's also been some bad ones. But to me, Shyamalan, well, other than the Sixth Sense, which I greatly admired, I am not on the M. Night Shyamalan bandwagon, except for his American Express commercial, I think, which was pretty good. But everything else just seems like kind of shysterism, and you know, he's like this showman who, when he pulls up the curtain, really nothing is there. You've got Samuel L. Jackson sort of emulating Prince in an ascot and a purple suit, and you've got James McAvoy, you know, doing his showy thing with the 12 personalities and really kind of quasi hulking it, but just going so over the top. And then you've got Bruce Willis in the green poncho, and it's like a glass is like a mosaic put together by a not gifted preschooler. I mean, it just doesn't come together. I felt like he was trying to go for some profundity,
yeah,
but it wasn't there.
So
like, I did not care for it. I'm glad you thought it had some redeeming qualities.
I think so. Do we see the glasses half full or not?
Justin.
Sorry. No, it's I and Lael, by and large, I'm with you in terms of my lack of enthusiasm for Shyamalan. I did like Split, and I thought that was a mm-hmm. return to form in some ways. What's interesting about him is that I think he's underappreciated in certain ways and overappreciated in others. I think he's still a very good craftsman. Like, mm-hmm. he knows how to shoot a scene. He knows how to build tension in the frame.
Mm-hmm.
He takes enormous care, maybe a little too much care sometimes with, you know. But the writing is where he is just completely let down.
It's the writing, and I think the editing as well sometimes. I felt like he often needed a better editor than he has.
He does trip up. He is sort of straining for profundity as well.
Mm.
Glass, the film from writer-director M. Night Shyamalan, starring Bruce Willis, Samuel L. Jackson, and James McAvoy. It's rated PG-13 in wide release. Then we've got a pair of documentaries, dueling documentaries, you might say, about the Fyre Festival, a music lifestyle festival at a secluded island. We have Netflix's Fyre, The Greatest Party That Never Happened. It's written and directed by Chris Smith. And we have Hulu's documentary, Fyre Fraud, which is from Jenner First and Julia Willoughby-Nason. Lael, let me start with you. First, the Netflix doc, Fyre, The Greatest Party That Never Happened.
So both of these docs are fascinating, and I would say they're both pretty compulsive viewing. The Netflix doc is structured a little more like a mystery, almost like a suspense thriller. It reminded me a little bit of the Enron documentary, The Smartest Guys in the Room, because it doesn't tell you what happens until later in the film. And so you're really kind of sitting on the edge of your seat. By way of background, Fyre was initiated by this guy, Billy McFarland, who was an internet entrepreneur who invented a credit card that called the Magnesis, which was a metal card to simulate the Amex, platinum
with
card.
With elite like benefits for, you know, New Yorkers and real these elite benefits that never really materialized.
Right. Yeah. And to basically to get millennials to feel like they were important and rich. And from there, he created a Fyre app, which was then had the notion of putting talent with bookers together in an expedient way, and then somehow this they generated this idea for this massive festival on a private island in the Bahamas that was once owned by Pablo Escobar.
And then it had to be moved to another island because they were not allowed to invoke Escobar's name, and so they had to go to the island of Great Exuma.
But only after they had, I think, filmed a video with some of the biggest supermodels in the world and people that are called, I learned these terms, influencers, who basically use their social media platforms to generate tens of thousands of responses.
And so it was advertised as this glamorous festival with live concerts by top musicians and gourmet food and luxury accommodations where you could go and
villas.
Get drunk, villas, and cavort with supermodels on the beach. And when the reality, in April 2017, festival goers showed up on this island and it looked more like a disaster zone.
They had FEMA tents
tents with like mattresses on gravel, basically.
Mattresses were left out in the rain.
There was barely any food or water, no organization. The musicians pulled out. It was just an epic debacle,
Right. They were... And you find out that that McFarlane was saying that there were acts that were booked that were never even booked.
Yes.
It was just a bubble. It was like, and he was preying on the faith of these millennials.
Let's listen to a clip from the documentary. This features an interview with Billy McFarland, the Hulu documentary Fyre Fraud, from Jenner First and Julia Willoughby-Nason.
I think it's really easy to played Monday morning quarterback for myself right now, looking back, saying I should have done this, I should have done that. And I certainly made a lot of mistakes, and there's no question about that. But before we had the worst luck, I think we had the best luck. And like it sounds crazy, but so many things had to go right to make it this big of a failure. And everybody fully believed that we were going to put on an event that was going to change the landscape and deliver an experience people will talk about for years.
Sounds like he still believes in the event.
Yeah, he does. That might be the most honest thing that Billy McFarland says.
It's one of the few insightful things I think mm-hmm. he says. And that interview, of course, is in Fire Fraud, the Hulu doc. I don't think any of us can remember a time when two documentaries on the same subject dropped the same week. And there is an element of trolling, I think.
Streaming services.
On streaming
services.
The Netflix one was slated to open this week for a while, and then the Hulu one dropped unexpectedly on Monday. And there's been a bit of a war that's broken out between the two dueling docs, because the Hulu doc paid for the interview with McFarland. Apparently it was offered to Netflix, but they didn't feel it was right to pay for it and thus benefit him financially even more after he had ripped off so many people. Meanwhile, the Hulu doc has come back with and saying that, well, yes, but Netflix was the Netflix doc was co-produced by Jerry Media, which was in charge of promoting the festival.
Right.
So that itself raises certain, dubious ethical issues
questions.
On both sides, it seems. Yeah.
I don't think
seems
that
appropriate. That
yeah,
very appropriate.
I mean, it's good
for what they're talking about.
It's good to ask the questions. I don't think the Netflix doc suffers for not having Billy mm-hmm. McFarland in it, because he is such a showman. You're not really ever sure if what you're getting from him is the truth when you're or what percent of it is in the Hulu doc. Some of the same people figure in both docs, interestingly. And to me, the Hulu doc was sort of more a little more comedic, a little more about the just about millennials and sort of like, how they're setting themselves up for this disaster in so many ways.
Yeah, it sort of argues that the Fyre Festival was like the apotheosis of millennial culture and social media obsession. I mean, here was this event that was sold entirely on the basis of a beautiful looking commercial promoted by very highly paid Instagram influencers. And the event just did not exist. The infrastructure did not exist. And it was just this enormous fraud that was perpetrated. So
let's hear a clip from the Netflix doc. This is about has festival attendees talking about what happened when they arrived on the island.
Everybody starts sprinting, running to their tents, grabbing bags.
We heard this voice, and then we heard this rush, and then we heard the scream, and we walked out, and there was just this mass of people going to tents.
It's an absolute circus. I don't know what's going on. I'm not getting off this ship until I know what's going on the island.
It's 8:36, and people are now just getting their luggage. These are the lockers that are just being set up. We are taking off the plastic that are supposed to hold our valuables.
There was no one who planned out luggage tags. They brought out the luggage in two big containers, like truck containers, like 18-wheeler containers. They just said, everyone grab your bag. And it was just a frenzy.
So is the takeaway here that the young people were kind of marks because they didn't do the due diligence. They just sort of they were had.
They don't come off particularly well, and a lot of the same footage plays in both documentaries of them showing up and seeing what they're in for. But why did you go? And why did you?
I remember the fact that they spent thousands, tens of thousands of dollars in some cases to go to this
for an event that's never been done. You'd think that people be a little cautious. And, well, let's see how it goes the first year if it's really comes together.
But they were lured by these celebrities, these influencers, these Kendall Jenner types, supermodels, and so forth, who were promised to them, I suppose, in that video, and they believed it, and they were also, they were told this is going to be better than Coachella, better than Burning Man, bigger and better, and so all of that, the hype, I mean, it was so much hype, and the fact that they bought into it without questioning, it doesn't make them look very good.
And this festival sold out in its first year, which they say is like, that never happens, and so there's something kind of fishy about that. I remember in April 2017 reading the tweets the viral sensation that this horror show became, the photos of the cheese sandwich and the nasty salad that went viral and just completely became the emblem of just the failure of this festival. And just the sense of schadenfreude that was in the air.
Yes.
Kind of, you couldn't help but laugh, I admit.
Yeah.
You know, just at the,
and it was also fascinating, too, because it was social media that exposed it as a fraud. There was a tweeter who I think that his handle was Fire Festival Fraud. Yeah. And so he was the first one who started exposing it, and that's when people started questioning, oh my gosh, what's going on? So it sort of created itself and brought itself down.
But I do recall that mainstream media coverage of this was kind of skeptical even early. So you had social media hyping it, but I remember like looking at the LA Times where there's sort of like, you know, really a little bit of a raised eyebrow about this also. We'll continue on Film Week with our critics. We're talking, by the way, about the two competing Fyre Festival documentaries, Fyre, the Greatest Party That Never Happened, streaming on Netflix, and Fyre Fraud, streaming on Hulu. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Justin Chang and Lael Lowenstein. Coming up later this hour, what are the most beautifully shot films of all time? There's so much great cinematography over the decades, and the American Society of Cinematography, to honor some of the art form, has come up with its top 10 list, as well as the top 100 films of the 20th century for the cinematography. Caleb Deschanel, the cinematographer, Oscar-nominated, multi-time nominee, joins us to talk about those films along with our critics shortly. But first, the 1966 film La Religieuse, or The Nun, has just been released. The film from Jacques Rivette, who directed the movie and co-wrote the screenplay. Justin, why is The Nun, or its French title, so important to see?
Yeah, this is the film La Religieuse is a 1966 movie that has been restored in 4K and is now playing in Lemley Theaters, I think, for the next few weeks, and you should absolutely see it. This film was very controversial at the time. In the 60s, even before it had been finished, conservative Catholic groups, the church really came down hard on it and tried to block its release. And they did so successfully, actually, for a year. The French Minister of Information blocked the film, and it ignited this scandal in the press. And there were protests. And, you know, the director, Jacques Rivette, who was, you know, one of the foundational figures of the French New Wave, and Jean-Luc Godard and Claude Chabrol got involved. And so if the movie finally did show at Cannes in 1966, and it was very much acclaimed, and people were a little bit confused, why was this so controversial? And the movie had, in fact, already been approved by censors, including one of my favorite details of the story, a mother superior who said, like, it's no big deal, it's pretty inaccurate portrayal. But the movie which is an adaptation of Denis Diderot's 18th century novel, epistolary novel, about a young novice who is basically forced to take vows against her will. And so the movie is effectively a prison movie, a great prison movie, where the inmate we're following is this young woman played by Anna Karina, who is herself an icon of the French New Wave and was once married to Godard. And it's fascinating to see her in this role where she has such a strikingly modern presence in great Godard movies like Vivre sa vie and Pierrot le Fou. And here she is, you know, giving this performance that is worthy in its expressiveness of a silent heroine in so many ways. So the film is in a way that Rivette would later be known for more radically experimental work, longer work too, films 4 hours, even 13 hours in length, his epic movie Out One. This one runs a very fleet 2 hours and 20 minutes, and it's incredibly absorbing. So some have said that this is sort of a minor work or an aberration, but it's a masterful movie, beautifully shot. You are, you know, very austere in the way of a lot of monastic dramas or in dramas about monastic life. But you are just with her at every step as she is persecuted. You see just the corruption of a social structure where the church is not really so much upholding the tenets of a truly pious life, but is completely in bed with the hierarchy, with the French aristocracy, the pre-revolutionary aristocracy at the times, where inconvenient women like Suzanne were basically shunted into convents because there was they couldn't, in her case, she couldn't, her family wasn't willing to pay her dowry and she was illegitimate. So it's a brilliant movie and it just looks great. The colors pop wonderfully.
Speaking of cinematography.
Yes, all right. Absolutely.
All right. The Nun, La Religieuse, 1966 film, now in a 2019 4K reissue at Lemley's Royal Theatre. It's rated PG. I hate kids. Comedy. No, not me personally. I Hate Kids, a comedy directed by John Asher, written by Frank Dietz and Todd Traina. Tom Everett Scott, Rachel Boston star in the film. Lael?
So the premise is that Tom Everett Scott's character is an author and a pundit who's written a book about why he hates kids. And he is about to get married to a woman who herself doesn't want to have children, and they celebrate on the eve of their wedding at their rehearsal dinner. They talk about how in sync they are. And meanwhile, the bride's very pregnant sister is sitting next to them and is about to, you know, go into labor pretty soon. And, you know, she's sort of disgruntled at the whole thing. Well, who should show up but a kid claiming to be the abandoned child of Tom Everett Scott? And he says, you know, he basically leaves a turd in the punch bowl of the of the rehearsal dinner and says, you know, I'm the kid that you had and you're the one that hates kids. So you better figure out how to make this right. So from that far flung original idea, he agrees to embark on a quest with the kid to find his mother. Oh, I forgot to mention there's a psychic who has verified that this is, you know, as only a psychic can, that this is actually true. And I guess they've done a DNA test with Tom Everett Scott's hair. They go on a quest to find who the actual mother was, interviewing a slew of girlfriends. This allows for some unbridled hilarity and some kind of stupid moments as well. It's an uneven film, but there are some funny turns. And I've always loved Tom Everett Scott ever since That Thing You Do. I can't not like him. So it's entertaining.
I Hate Kids, comedy starring Scott, John Asher, the director. It's rated PG-13 at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset in Hollywood. The Canadian-U.S. co-production, The Standoff at Sparrow Creek, a mystery film starring James Badge Dale and Brian Garrity. It's written and directed by Henry Dunham. Justin?
This is Mr. Dunham's debut feature, and I think it has a lot of talent. I wish it added up to more, but it's under 90 minutes. Very, very taut script and direction. It's very much worth seeing. This movie begins with word of a mass shooting that has taken place somewhere in rural Michigan, and we later learn that the shooting apparently happened at a police funeral. And most of the movie, however, takes place in this lumber warehouse that is stocked with military-grade weapons and turns out to be the lair of a self-styled anti-government militia. And so we are spending all of our time with the seven members of this militia who gather and go into damage control mode because they know that law enforcement is going to descend on their compound and search for evidence. And rightly so, it turns out, because one of their AR-15 assault rifles has gone missing and they realize, yeah, the killer walks among them. So it's a weird, discomfiting mix of very topical stuff about gun culture and about right-wing paranoia and extremism in this sort of Reservoir Dogs, Agatha Christie format. And it's a fascinating way to tackle these issues. And the twists of the storytelling are very well measured out, maybe a bit too well measured out, because there's something a bit mechanical that seeps into the structure. You mentioned Reservoir Dogs, but also Dunham's dialogue very much takes its cues from like early David Mamet, that kind of rat-a-tat rhythm. It's interesting because this is a movie where the threat of violence is always looming, but there is actually very, very little violence on the screen. It's very spare. It is all about the dialogue, all about the interactions between these men as they are interrogating each other and suspicion is falling on each of them in turn. James Badge Dale gives a very good performance. So does Brian Garrity, Chris Mulkey as the leader. It's a well-done movie. I don't think it adds up to much. I think it tends to faint in the direction of the themes it's raising more than it really explores them and more than it really fleshes out the characters in the end. But it is a very, very promising debut.
The Standoff at Sparrow Creek, unrated, from Henry Dunham, the writer-director. It's at the Lemley Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. All These Small Moments, starring Molly Ringwald, Brian D'Arcy James, and Brendan Meyer. It's written and directed by Melissa B. Miller, also a feature debut. Leah, what'd you think of All These Small Moments?
I thought this was a collection of small and wonderful moments that added up to a pretty decent film. It's about the coming apart of a parent's marriage and the coming of age of this adolescent boy. He develops a crush on a beautiful girl on the bus he sees every day, but there's another girl who has an interest in him who he's not interested in, and there's kind of wonderfully rich dialogue and some nuanced moments that feel very real. Apparently the writer director Melissa B. Miller was also worked in the art department quite a bit before and in various films, and so she has the scenes, the sets have a real lived-in quality, and there's a real sort of texture to them. It reminded me just a little bit, although not as sharp as Squid and the Whale, Noah Baumbach's movie that I loved about also a marriage coming apart and a family in New York. So this was really nice to see Molly Ringwald playing the mom of an adolescent also.
Yeah. All These Small Moments from writer-director Melissa B. Miller. It's unrated. Lemley's Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. Don't Come Back from the Moon. A British-U.S. co-production. James Franco, Rashida Jones, Jeff Wahlberg star. The film is directed by Bruce Thierry Chung, who co-wrote the screenplay. Justin?
Yeah, this is a lovely, dreamlike coming-of-age drama about parental abandonment and teenage romance and teenage misbehavior. It's set against the backdrop of Bombay Beach, which is a salt and sea resort community, and it has a really wonderful sense of place to it. The director, Bruce Thierry Chung, has worked primarily as a cinematographer on a lot of James Franco's films, and Franco has a small role in it. The movie's adapted from a novel that was actually set in the Rust Belt, and now it's been moved to the Salton Sea. And it's told mainly from the perspective of a teenager named Mickey, who tells us in this lyrical voiceover at the outset that, you know, this town used to be a major holiday destination, but then the lake dried up and all the job opportunities dried up along with it, and now men are leaving their families behind. And one of these dads leaves a note behind saying he's gone to the moon. And so going to the moon becomes a kind of shorthand for this epidemic of husbands and fathers leaving. And so James Franco plays Mickey's father, and his mother is played by Rashida Jones in a really lovely, heartbreakingly restrained performance. This movie weirdly reminded me a little bit of We the Animals from the past year, which had a similar dynamic. That one, there were three kids, you know, but similar kind of dynamic and loose-limbed kind of feel to it. Mickey has this younger brother whom he's very close to, and there are a lot of scenes of young people and their aimless, drifty experience, and, you know, he falls into a sexual relationship with two different girls. There is this pronounced Terrence Malick, David Gordon Green vibe, early David Gordon Green vibe to the cinematography, the sort of gently lurching handheld camera work, the scenes that are set at magic hour. There's cutaways to seagulls, you know, and you're watching that kind of movie when you see cutaways to seagulls, but it really works, I think. The movie doesn't feel just imitative to me. I think the style really wells up beautifully from this time and place, and there's a lot of poetry and soul to it.
It's based on the book from Dean Bacopoulos, Please Don't Come Back from the Moon. Bacopoulos co-wrote the screenplay with the director, Bruce Thierry Chung. James Franco, Rashida Jones, Jeff Wahlberg star. The film is unrated, Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. Close, a British action thriller starring Noemi Rapace, Indira Varma. It's directed by Vicky Jewson, who co-wrote the screenplay with Rupert Whitaker. Lael.
Yes, there's no beautiful cutaways to seagulls in this movie. This is a straight out kind of action thriller, and in fact, I would say not one of the better ones. But Rapace and her story is actually based on a real life female security agent. So that's what's interesting about it. She gets to be top security and kick some serious butt. She is guarding a very entitled young woman who is kind of stranded by her father, and who's just died, and her stepmother left in Morocco and doesn't want Noemi anywhere near her. And she has to dodge and get around a lot of really serious bad guys. It's not a great movie, but there's some really good action in it.
Film is close. From Nomi Rapace is the star, Vicky Jewson, the director and co-screenwriter. Unrated, and it's streaming on Netflix. Coming up, what do you think are some of the most beautifully filmed movies of all time? We're going to talk about the art of cinematography. The American Society of Cinematographers out with its top 10 list of best shot films of all time. That to come right here on Film Week.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
The theme from the brilliant film Lawrence of Arabia, David Lean, the director, the 1962 Oscar-winning film Best Picture, starring Peter O'Toole, Omar Sharif, and Alec Guinness, shot by Freddie Young. This scene from the film actually takes you into a bar where Lawrence delivers the news about the taking of a very important city.
We've taken Aqaba.
Taken Aqaba? Who has?
We have. Our side in this war has. The Wogs have. We have.
He likes your lemonade.
You mean the Turks have gone?
No, they're still there, but they've no boots. Prisoners, sir. We took them prisoners, the entire garrison. No, that's not true. We killed some. Too many, really. I'll manage it better next time. It's been a lot of killing, one way or another.
Cross my heart and hope to die. It's all perfectly true.
It isn't possible.
Yes, it is. I did it.
It's Anthony Quayle as well in that scene. The classic Lawrence of Arabia, chosen by the American Society of Cinematographers as the best shot film of all time. We're going to talk about many other movies, but I would love to hear from you, if you're listening live on our Friday Film Week, your pick for the most beautifully filmed movie in history. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Joining me, multi-time Oscar-nominated cinematographer Caleb Deschanel, a member of the American Society of Cinematographers. The films that he's shot, including The Gem Being There, The Right Stuff for Philip Kaufman, The Natural, Barry Levinson's movies, Fly Away Home, for which he was Oscar-nominated, The Patriot, the Roland Emmerich movie, The Passion of the Christ from Mel Gibson. More recently, Jack Reacher, Winter's Tale, and The Lion King, currently in production. Caleb, thank you for being with us. Appreciate
sure,
it
no,
so much.
Great to be here.
So for you as someone who you're immersed in this and a working cinematographer, when you watch a film, how closely are you looking at technically what you're seeing? Or do you, like the rest of us, just get lost in the movie and that fades away?
If the movie's good, I just watch it and enjoy it as a movie. And then maybe later I'll think about it in terms of the cinematography. So I really feel, you know, any great movie sort of sweeps you away and you're blind to all the, you know, the technical details.
How difficult is it for you to come up with a list of your own 10 personal favorites?
It's really impossible because every time I come up with a list, I keep thinking of more and more films. I'm on the board of the Library of Congress, and each year we have to pick 25 films for, you know, preservation. And it's almost impossible when you hear, you know, everybody, you know, putting in their two cents about what they think should be in there. And there's so many movies that, you know, really deserve recognition that just get lost along the way.
And describe for us the range, depending on the director for whom a cinematographer is working, of how much latitude and input the cinematographer has on composing what's being filmed.
Well, it really depends on the director. I mean, you know, you're really working with the director to kind of tell this story. I mean, you're usually drawn in by the script and then, you know, talking to the director, you know, how you feel like you can contribute to it. So, I mean, I find that, you know, I'm generally attracted to people who really, you know, like what I do and want me to do what I do. So that's usually the criteria that, you know, that draws you into making a movie. I mean, I always find that it's one of the great things about making movies is that you have this great relationship with the director and with the actors and with all your crew. And it's something that gets put together for a period of time and then it disappears. And it's sort of unfortunate that, you know, our world is always, you know, kind of ephemeral, you know, and you hope to have those experiences again. And sometimes you do and sometimes you don't.
How do you describe, you said you like to work with directors who like what you do. How do you describe what you do as a cinematographer? What are the key things you bring to a film?
Well, I mean, I like to think that I read a script and I sort of try to understand the emotion of the script. And then I try to find the sort of visual equivalence of the emotion within a story. And that's kind of what you do as a cinematographer. I mean, it's, you know, you talk about the most beautiful pictures, but in a weird way, it's more, you know, a visual, you know, telling of a story that really makes beautiful cinematography in the sense that, you know, you can have ugly images that tell a wonderful story that are appropriate, you know, that are gritty and, you know, difficult to look at it sometimes, but appropriate for that particular story. So I think, you know, it's more than just beautiful photography, although The List has some of the most beautiful films made.
Well, and I guess when I think of beauty in a film, I don't necessarily think of that in the conventional pretty. I think of beauty as the powerful of the emotions being conveyed that you're, well, you know, I can think of crime films that are, you know, beautifully shot with horrific images, but they're beautiful.
Yeah, no, well, I agree with that. That's very much.
Justin, what films for you stand out as you think are the most impressively shot?
Oh, there's so many. Like Caleb, I look down the list and I see I can't argue with that. names that stand out to me, certainly Gordon Willis, who I know is one of your mentors, Caleb. And right. So, you know, and a great cinematographer known particularly for his 70s work, like All the President's Men and The Parallax View and especially The Godfather. I still remember seeing The Godfather Part II on the big screen for the first time and just being struck by the visual extremity of it, just the darkness, these walls of shadows for which Willis was very much known. It wasn't the only thing he did, but it was and I always find that for me it's been, I think, becoming more aware of cinematography is crucial as a critic. Sometimes we read reviews and we read what critics are writing and you wouldn't necessarily know that we're writing about a visual medium. And so one always tries to acknowledge that and just to look at and see it, how the texture of the images, the framing and everything are shaping the meaning of the story. So I think it's important.
Lael, what are some of your favorites?
Well, certainly Days of Heaven is one, the absolutely gorgeous Nestor Almendros shot film that is unparalleled to my mind. One of your own, Black Stallion, Caleb, is right up there for me.
Speaking of beautiful.
Yeah, so beautiful. And, of course, The Natural, which you also shot. I also love Sunrise, which was the Murnau film shot, I think that was like 1927, which was, you know, very, very, very early cinema technology, but just so beautiful, the play of light and shadow. And then, yeah. I mean, there's so many more. I wanted to also give a shout out to the documentary Visions of Light that you're also in, Caleb. It's been like a quarter of a century now since that came out, but it's one of the most comprehensive and, well, up until that point, and really insightful and incisive looks at what cinematographers do.
We're at 866-893-KPCC. If you're listening to Film Week live on Friday, you can call, let us know what you think is the best shot film of all. We're paying tribute to cinematographers and the great composition of films. You mentioned Gordon Willis, Justin, and I was thinking of Manhattan.
Absolutely.
That great black and white photography Willis did there.
Well, what's really amazing about, if you look at the top 10 that they list, I mean, three were Academy Award winners, and four actually were never nominated, including The Godfather was not nominated, Manhattan was never nominated. I mean, it's really interesting to look back from the present time at what really stands out. And even though 28 of the films on the top 100 that are listed by the American Cinematographer, there were like something like 40-some films that never got any nominations or any kind of recognition.
Isn't that fascinating? Yeah, that in the moment, it's a different judgment. By the way, the other films I mentioned, Lawrence of Arabia, Freddie Young cinematography, number one, Blade Runner, number two, Jordan Cronenweth's film, Apocalypse Now, Vittorio Storaro, Citizen Kane, Greg Toland, The Godfather, Gordon Willis, Raging Bull, Michael Chapman, The Conformist, Vittorio Storaro, Days of Heaven, Nestor Almendros, 2001, A Space Odyssey, Jeffrey Unsworth, and The French Connection, Owen Roisman. Back in a minute. Or you just hear the first few notes on the trumpet, you know which film you're talking about, The Godfather, one of the top 10 best shot films of all time, according to the American Society of Cinematographers. It's a great way for them to really highlight the terrific work of their membership, historically, as well as those who are working, like Caleb Deschanel, who joins us, multi-Oscar-nominated cinematographers, worked on so many great films. But we open up the lines for you to weigh in also with us, Lael and Justin, our critics. And let's talk with Jesse in Burbank. Jesse, your couple of favorite best shot films.
Well, I don't know if it's the greatest ever, but one of my big favorites is The Third Man.
Yes, Carol Reed film.
Yes, beautiful black and white, great Dutch angles. And in fact, there's a shot that David Lean echoed in Lawrence of Arabia. I'm talking about the final shot of The Third Man, where Alida Valli is walking toward the camera and Joseph Cotten's sort of waiting for her, and he walked right past him. I think it's echoed in that shot of David Lean's, where Omar Sharif is on the camel coming from way far away and finally gets up to where Lawrence is. So I think that's a beautiful use of photography. Right?
Robert Krasker, the cinematographer, and The Third Man.
And it won the Academy Award that year for best black and white cinematography. So
yeah. Great
film.
It
has been recognized and is on the list of 100.
I just watched it for the second time a couple weeks ago. Such a great film. Jesse, thank you so much. Mike in West Hollywood, your pick for best shot film?
I would say that it would be Barry Lyndon, directed by Stanley Kubrick in 1975, shot by John Alcott. And what stands out to me about that film is that the interior scenes are shot, the nighttime interior scenes are shot with just a available candlelight in the room. And at that time, it was revolutionary to shoot that type of scene without any artificial lighting. And it really evoked what it would have actually looked like to be in that time period. So that film just knocks me out. It's beautifully shot.
Mike, I appreciate it. Caleb?
Yeah, well, Barry Lyndon, they found a lens that was developed for NASA that was like a 0.5 lens that was really wide open and very little depth of field. But they were able to shoot with, they would have other candles outside of frame, but they shot these scenes with, candlelight that was just absolutely extraordinary. And again, it won the Academy Award and is also on the list.
Gabe writes on our Film Week page, Days of Heaven and I Am Cuba, Visual Poetry. The Beach Battle, Ridley Scott's Robin Hood, spectacular, according to Pippi, writing on the page. And Yvonne writes, I know there are movies with better shots, but I've always thought North by Northwest was well shot, especially the scene where Cary Grant's running and the crop dusters coming after him. Also, the Mount Rushmore scenes. I mean, yeah, that's visual spectacle almost end to end. And North by Northwest, as many of Hitchcock's films are. It's funny, we don't tend to think of the visuals of the Hitchcock film as great as they were, Justin.
But it's true. I mean, the line about Hitchcock always is that you can turn the sound off, so and you can follow it completely. So maybe his films are not known maybe as much for their pictorial splendor, but in terms of just, you know, telling a story visually.
Yeah, I mean, his films have such strict point of view. I mean, almost to the point that when someone's driving a car, you'll see the hands on the steering wheel in front of you, and you really get into the characters that he's telling the stories about. So it's great.
Belinda wanted to point out the newest version of Pride and Prejudice with Keira Knightley. And let's see, I mentioned the top 10 films, but there also is a top 100 list of the 20th century. And I believe we have that on our Film Week page as well. So you can look up those movies. Bobby Rivers tweeting at our AirTalk account says the Mexican cinematographer Gabriel Figueroa did beautiful work in black and white, Night of the Iguana, and his 1947 Mexican film La Perla, the Pearl, ones that he wants to point out. These are American films we're specifically looking at, Caleb, aren't they?
Although on the 100, there are quite a few foreign films, and most of the foreign films didn't get recognized by the Academy because they were foreign films. But, in reviewing them from, you know, the present time and looking back, they've been recognized. I mean, like Rashomon and The Conformist and a lot of really wonderful films that were, you know, in a foreign language and would get nominated for Best Foreign Language Film, but oftentimes not recognized for the cinematography.
Leo. I just wanted to ask one thing, Caleb. I know that you guys, in compiling this list, use sort of the postage stamp theory of films have to have a certain vintage to be considered. So you did only 20th century. But we're almost 20 years into the new century, and there's been a number of really beautifully shot films that can't be on this list, including even some this year, like Roma, which has just got spectacular cinematography. Can you comment on that a little bit?
You mean why they decided to hold off?
Or if you could include more recent ones, what would you include?
Oh, that's really unfair. But I would say I agree with you. There are a great number of films. I mean, Chivo has done, you know, like three films that won Oscars in a row. And, you know, he's really extraordinary. And Roger Deakins. And I mean, there's so many wonderful cinematographers. But I sort of think it's good to keep it at a distance just for the sake of the fact that there are 100 films within just the 20th century that should be recognized. Mm-hmm. And maybe in the next 50 years or something, we'll reassess it and make a list for the 21st century. Mm-hmm.
In Mid-City, Scott joins us on Film Week. Scott, you have a particular cinematographer you want to highlight.
Yeah, Burnett Guffey, he won an Oscar for Bonnie and Clyde. That was color cinematography. And he also won an Oscar for From Here to Eternity, and that's black and white cinematography. I don't know if he's the only one who ever did that.
All right, Caleb, do you have any idea?
I don't know.
All right. Scott, thank you so much. Lydia in Alger, Ohio, called to say Spider-Man, the first with Tobey Maguire, beautifully shot film. The colors so vivid, great incandescent glow, like something you would have seen in the 1940s. Vinny in Pasadena also wants to highlight the documentary about cinematographers, Visions of Light, that you mentioned, Lael, the same documentary, really says that's a must-see. And Lorena in Highland Park, Under the Tuscan Sun, real underappreciated, the visuals key to moving the story along, a beautifully shot film. Sparky tweets at Air Talk, Dersu Ursula by Kurosawa. Leo?
Oh, I just wanted to answer that question. Janusz Kaminski won for black and white and color cinematography. For Saving Black and White was Schindler's List, and Saving Private Ryan was the colors.
And Haskell Wexler also for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Oh,
and,
yes. You know, speaking of black and white.
Bound for Glory, for color.
For color. Puka tweets that Air Talk, Once Upon a Time in the West, makes the camera a far larger contributor to telling the story than dialogue right from the start. All right, you can share your comments by tweeting at Air Talk or on our Film Week page, kpcc.org. Caleb Deschanel, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you. It's been fun.
We appreciate it. As a member of the American Cinematographers Society, which has put out this top 10 list of the best shot movies of all time, I'm sure that was a very contested process, plus their 100 best shot films of the 20th century. For our Film Week critics, I'm Larry Mantle. Have a wonderful weekend from all of us at Film Week.